Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. This book is the true story of 25-year-old Amy St. Laurent, who disappeared in Portland's Old Port, and the police work that was involved in solving her brutal murder. The book is inscribed to Amy Elizabeth St. Laurent and to all those officers out there who believe. When night darkens the streets, then wander forth the sons of Belial, flown with insolence and wine. John Milton, Paradise Lost. Prologue. Welcome to the cop's life. I can still recall clearly some of my first days and years on the street after I graduated from the academy. I remember physically shaking on my first call at a domestic disturbance. Training, films, instructor warnings, and danger signals raced through my mind as we made our way up the dark, cold, urine-stained stairwell. A man was screaming, a woman sobbing, and neighbors pointing as glass showered down on us from the third floor. The senior officer I was assigned to, Cleo Kelly, made it all look so easy. He was more interested in talking about the Celtics than concentrating on our task. I was thinking we were about to be killed. We ended up arresting the man after a brief struggle and counseling the bruised woman as she begged us not to take him away. The scene at the booking room was just as disturbing. One man was rocking back and forth crying, another spitting and cursing at everyone. Tough guys stared ahead and right through me. Shouts and curses echoed down the hall from the tanks where violent offenders were placed. A man smashed his head against the wall. Metal doors slammed shut. Electric buzzers rang out amidst the shouting and screaming. I thought this was what hell must be like. After a while, it all runs together, and you forget most of what you are exposed to on the job. By the end of my first year, one of my colleagues was shot in the face. My partner had a breakdown and left the job. And a short while later, another officer committed suicide. Yet, I couldn't leave. It was too interesting, too challenging, and a place where I could do good for the world. It was in my blood, as they say. One day in the summer, I had a fairly busy shift, involving some routine and some disturbance calls. One call was for an infant in distress at an apartment. The baby was not breathing. Paramedics and I worked on the baby as the parents tugged and howled at us to help. The apartment was filthy. The man had broken bones from a fall, and both legs were in casts, and the baby died in our arms. I distinctly remember that smell and how white the infant looked. After all the reports, I moved on to the next call for service and the next, adjusting my emotions each time to meet the situation. Later, taking a break at a Dunkin' Donuts to get a large fruit punch, which I paid for, a man called over to me. "Hey, you guys have it made, don't you? Drive round all day and get free food." I returned to my car, thinking about all I had seen that day alone, then drove behind a building to drink my drink, hoping not to be disturbed by another run, and started sobbing about the baby. It's 18 years later. I'm the lieutenant in charge of CID, the Criminal Investigations Division. I've been to hundreds of deaths and horrible crime scenes. It's easier now, almost routine. Now I sit with other detectives in a hotel conference room, passing around photos with casual indifference, speculation, and study, like people passing around a report or stats at a board meeting. Different conversations float in the air. "Now that's crap. She was dead before he tied her up. Look here, look at her hands, the lividity." I am distracted by another detective as he nudges and points to the Polaroid. God knows what happened to this poor girl. These are not ordinary photos. These are horrible death scenes involving torture and rape. One girl, her nostrils flared, mouth agape, sucking down her last breath in panic. Nice white teeth, lips curled back like an angry dog's, all sorts of emotions running through her last thoughts. Beautiful long brown hair. Yep, she fits the profile all right. Different agencies are trying to match up the work of a serial killer we think worked in our area. As the meeting goes on, some are even bored with the routine of it. We've witnessed so much tragedy over the years, we can view these victims without emotion. I pause and think, God, if normal people saw stuff like this, they'd be asking for counseling and wouldn't sleep for weeks. Our board meeting continues as photos are tossed around like trading cards. Ironically, we can often see through the horror. Hey, look at this one, somebody says. She's good-looking. Early 20s, her pretty eyes rolled up with a panicked look, amazed at what is happening to her. This girl is all tied up neatly by a monster with an eye for detail. Anger wells up towards the suspected perpetrator of these despicable acts, a killer who trained others to follow in his footsteps. Talk about the death penalty. Easy when you see this kind of stuff. What about the families, friends, children? Juries and citizens will never see these pictures, never be exposed to the whole truth. We discuss the details with words like positioning, stains, fibers, hair, DNA, petechia, ligature marks. Detectives Dumas and Creer are arguing. Look, you moron, it's Investigation 101. You should know that. Hey, John, look at this. What's up with the red lividity? That's odd. The voices merge together until they sound like one noise. After the meeting, I stop on the way home for a steak dinner. I want to be alone, sitting at the bar enjoying a few beers. Mellow feelings wash over me as I wait for my food, dim voices blending with the music. I listen to simple talk and regular lives, people who aren't exposed to the extremes of life's underside. I hear someone talk about a big problem, something about her nails, and think, lady, you don't know what problems are. This is what it's like for cops, day and night. Night and day, year after year, the unimaginable things pile up. At the academy and on the job, they teach us objectivity. Keep an emotional distance. Separate yourself. After a while, we can see things like today's crime scene pictures without much emotional response. Mostly it works, but sometimes things get stuck in your head, haunting your dreams and interrupting your thoughts because they matter so goddamned much. A case involving a beautiful girl named Amy St. Laurent was one of those. Chapter 1. It is every parent's nightmare. Your child goes out one Saturday night and vanishes off the face of the earth. It is also, sadly, something that happens far too often. A sensible and independent young woman, who thinks she knows how to take care of herself, crosses paths with a predator. The bad guy doesn't look evil. He's charming, charismatic, lively, and fun. It is only when he has his victim alone that his true self, his violent, explosive, self-indulgent, and remorseless side, emerges. Suddenly, a lifetime of striving toward maturity and self-awareness, of good decisions and generous acts, is changed by one bad choice. This is one of those stories. On Saturday night, October 20th, 2001, a lovely blonde woman with a generous heart and a happy disposition set out to show a new acquaintance from Florida the nightlife in the Old Port area of Portland, Maine. After an evening shooting pool and dancing, 25-year-old Amy St. Laurent disappeared. This is the story of how a group of tenacious detectives solved the case. From the start, it was an unusual situation. They had no body, no crime scene, no witnesses. Only their certainty, based on years of experience, about what the circumstances suggested, and an ever-deepening determination to find the young woman they had never known when she was alive, but who became, over the course of the investigation, our Amy. They had a complex tangle of lies and half-truths to unravel. A cocky young suspect partying under their noses, shielded by the inaccurate stories, fuzzy or false recall, and inaction of friends and relatives who couldn't believe someone they knew could be a killer. They had difficult jurisdictional and territorial issues to resolve, personal style differences, crushing workloads, weeks of 16 to 20-hour workdays ticked by with no resolution as a Maine winter came relentlessly toward them, the holidays approached, and the family's agony of uncertainty pressed them on. This is a story about the way real-world investigation works, from the first phone call and the intensity of the first week through the long, miserable grind of many more weeks, then months. It details the way detectives collect information, evaluate that information, formulate theories, and continuously test and retest their theories as new facts become known. How they work under pressure from a desperate family, a worried public, the media, the command staff, and city government, knowing that haste truly can make waste, and that a good investigation must be detailed, careful, and methodical. The whole enterprise is informed by their knowledge of the ways they'll be tested when a case comes to court. This is a story of good, old-fashioned police work, not the sexy, solve-it-in-an-hour forensics of CSI or the intense, sweat-em-in-the-box psychological manipulations of David Simon's Homicide. In the real world, the investigation, arrest, and trial don't happen neatly in an hour, as they do on Law and Order. They happen piece by slow, determined, painstaking piece through a complex interweaving of different detective skills. The investigation took thousands of hours of legwork, phone calls, interviewing, and report writing. Careful listening informed by instinct and experience. Meetings and arguments and a continuous reassessment of the story. Patience and taking chances. Overcoming legal hurdles, refusing to take no for an answer, and coming to know the victim and the suspect extremely well. The investigators weighed a number of suspects, testing the veracity of their often incredible stories, until they fixed on a young man devoid of empathy and self-discipline, whose goal in life was to have sex with as many women as possible, who regarded women solely as objects for his satisfaction, believing he had a right to be satisfied, no matter what the cost. A young man who would prove even to experienced detectives to be shockingly cold-blooded in the lengths he would go to hide his crime. This is also a story of unusual interagency cooperation, of strong bonds formed where territorialism and suspicion normally reigned, of a case that might never have been successfully resolved, a body that should never have been found, of dark dreams and psychics' maps and divine intervention. This is the story of how some good and dedicated cops relentlessly tested the evidence and the suspect until the false stories unraveled, waiting for the missteps that would give them their breaks, and in the way of the best homicide investigators did not give up until they had found their Amy and brought her killer to justice. Portland is Maine's largest city. With a residential population of around 70,000, it is one of the largest cities north of Boston. During business and entertainment hours, the population swells to 150,000. The population of the surrounding area is about 300,000. The city's old downtown sits atop a hill on a boot-shaped peninsula surrounded by the Four River, Back Cove, Portland Harbor, and Casco Bay. At the east end and west end, the toe and heel of the boot, there are lovely vistas. Daily ferry service carries residents to the city from the many inhabited islands that rise from the sparkling waters of the bay. Like many anchor cities in predominantly rural states, Portland is a city in transition. Once a charming port of old brick storefronts, warehouses, and wharf buildings, thriving department stores and businesses, overwhelmingly white and homogenized, by the mid-60s it was hit hard by the decline of small manufacturing. Many of the warehouse buildings near the waterfront were abandoned or became decrepit. In the streets near the projects on Munjoy Hill, disgruntled residents partied and battled and lit bonfires in the streets. A few people with vision, seeing what urban revivals had done for other cities, bought buildings and started to restore the old port area, streets of fine brick buildings and old warehouses leading down to a working waterfront. Today the old port is a mecca for tourists who come by car, Amtrak, and off-cruise ships and flock to the interesting shops and restaurants. Urban and suburban couples come to enjoy theater and music and the old port's fine restaurants. At night, it also becomes a destination for another crowd. Young people from as far away as Boston come to enjoy the restaurants, bars, and clubs that line the brick and cobbled streets. Underage teens looking for life beyond the empty streets of their small towns rub elbows with bikers, college students, drug dealers, gangsters, and young professionals. Fights are common. Crowd control is a perennial problem, especially late in the evening as the bars and clubs close, releasing thousands of patrons who are drunk, rowdy, and uninhibited onto the narrow old streets. At closing time, the swarm of bodies on Wharf Street can become so dense in the summer months that uniformed cops find it difficult to see each other when they're only 10 to 15 feet apart. The same years that have seen Portland's Old Port revival have also seen the city transformed in other ways. Increasingly, the city has had to deal with sharp rises in two populations that require a lot of police intervention: the homeless and the mentally ill, drawn from other cities, small towns, and rural areas to the shelters, the community service agencies, and cheap rooming houses the city offers. Portland has also seen a rise in drug use, bringing with it the associated drug-related violence, overdoses, and deaths. Heroin is rampant, as is cocaine. In 2001, there were 20 deaths from drug overdoses, along with hundreds of close calls suffered by users who were saved because of the city's fine medical facilities. Added to this are the complexities of dealing with the new immigrant populations. In particular, Portland has seen an influx of Vietnamese and Cambodians, and more recently, many refugees from Africa and Eastern Europe. All these populations have brought added language and cultural difficulties to the usual challenges of policing an urban area. The city is served by a 165-person police department headquartered at 109 Middle Street on the edge of the Old Port area. Each year, Portland police respond to approximately 75,000 calls for service, mostly 911 calls. They are dispatched to over 2,000 domestic violence cases and over 100 death scenes, including suicides, homicides, and drug overdose deaths, as well as to burglaries, rapes, terrible child abuse, and vicious assaults. For 17 years, the department was presided over by Chief Michael Chitwood, a former Philadelphia detective. In Philadelphia, his flamboyant style and controversial record led critics to call him Dirty Harry. In Portland, his outspoken style and strong public stance on issues such as concealed weapons permits, children in horrendous home situations where the Department of Human Services wouldn't act, and district attorneys who settled too many cases earned him the nickname Media Mike. Chitwood was a strong and controversial leader in a department recently under fire for alleged police brutality. Despite these controversies, he was very popular with the public, who felt he was making the city safer, and he forged good relationships with the media. However controversial he might have been on many fronts, an article in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine called him both a smooth operator and a loose cannon. Chief Chitwood had a passionate concern for crime victims. Throughout his career, his press conferences, often held with victims and their families, helped the media and the public understand the true impact of crime on ordinary people. Portland is a microcosm of any large U.S. city, and its troubles are a microcosm of any big city's woes. But even for Portland police, who see stabbings, beatings, child abuse, drug overdoses, pedophiles, rapes, and suicides on a regular basis, a murder is still a big deal. In an average year, there are between 25 and 30 murders in the entire state of Maine. A genuine whodunit, as opposed to a domestic murder, a drunken dispute settled by violence, or a drug deal gone bad, is rare. The challenge of solving a murder triggers all the hardwired investigative responses trained into a personal crimes detective. For the best detectives, it immediately becomes a contest they must win. Police involvement in the Amy St. Laurent case began with one of those informal cop-to-cop phone calls the public rarely hears about. At 7:30 p.m. on Monday, October 22, 2001, Cumberland County Deputy Sheriff James Estabrook called his friend Danny Young, a Portland police detective, at home, and asked if he could speak about a missing South Berwick woman. The young woman, Amy St. Laurent, was the daughter of a friend of Estabrook's girlfriend. She had gone out on Saturday night to show a visitor from Florida the nightlife in Portland's Old Port District. She had never come home. Estabrook made his call to the right receptive ear. Danny Young, a tenacious investigator with finely honed cop's instincts and 21 years on the job, had a daughter the same age as the missing woman. And her name was Amy. Detective Young himself defines stable and decent. He's married to the high school sweetheart he met at age 15 and is a devoted father and grandfather. A heavy-set man with a comfortable, fatherly, engaging manner, Danny Young exudes the kind of warmth and amiability that makes him deceptively easy to talk to. But behind that genial exterior is a dedicated homicide detective. Young is known for his encyclopedic grasp of the details of a case, as well as an anal retentive's compulsion for order and filing. Along with his charm, Young has the naturally competitive pit bull quality of the true detective. He will work tirelessly because he's not going to let the bad guys win, leaving victims and their families to suffer a double set of losses and betrayals. Supervisors say Young is the detective they'd want on the case if something happened to one of their family members. Estabrook had been lucky to find him at home. Since the events of September 11th, Young had been working 7 days a week. Along with his detective duties, he was also a bomb investigator. As part of the post-9/11 heightened security, he and his bomb dog, Carla, had been patrolling the Scotia Prince, the ferry that provided service between Portland and Nova Scotia, every evening. He was also regularly called out for patrols at the airport and other locations. The night of Estabrook's call was his first Monday night at home in more than a month. He was half an hour into Monday night football when the phone rang. Young listened carefully to Estabrook's information about the missing woman and asked some questions. He then followed up with phone calls to the woman's mother, Diane Jenkins, and to the South Berwick police. Good cops are adept at applying their investigative instincts to the facts. Danny Young had spent a lot of years assessing situations and sorting out facts, and the story he was hearing didn't feel right. Normally, when an adult goes missing, it is not an immediate cause for alarm. In any given year, the Portland police get reports of around 200 missing persons. The reasons people disappear are usually related to drugs, alcohol, financial or relationship problems, mental health issues, or general irresponsibility. Most of those reported missing eventually turn up, often expressing surprise or even annoyance that anyone bothered to worry. It wasn't unusual for an attractive single 25-year-old woman to go out on Saturday night and not come home. But it was unusual for this missing woman, Amy St. Laurent, a caring owner who was devoted to her cat, not to return on Sunday or Monday to feed it. Because of the cat, she rarely stayed at her mother's South Portland house late in the evening or overnight. If she did stay overnight somewhere else, she always went home in the morning to check on the cat or arranged for someone else to feed it. It was also unusual for this woman to let days go by without a call to her mother or her younger sister, Julie. Amy St. Laurent belonged to the cell phone generation. She was regularly in touch with people by phone and email, and she was close to her mother and her younger sister. She was also close to her father, Dennis, who lived nearby in South Berwick. If she needed help with the cat, or a ride because her car was in the shop, she would give him a call. But Amy St. Laurent hadn't been home or called anyone for 2 days. It was more unusual still for St. Laurent, an ambitious young woman who had worked her way from the third shift assembly line at the Pratt & Whitney Aircraft Engine Assembly Plant to a responsible administrative position, not to show up at work on Monday. Plenty of young adults are haphazard about their jobs or work only to get the money to go out and party, but St. Laurent was not one of them. When she had to miss a day and knew in advance, she would let someone know. If she was sick, she would always call in or email, but no one at Pratt & Whitney had heard from her. Although she had been an honors student in high school, she had chosen not to go to college. Perhaps in part to compensate for that, she had taken a very professional approach to her work. She had been employed at P&W for several years, moving from the Portland area to South Berwick, 40 miles away, to be closer to her job. She was pleased by her promotion to an administrative assistant position, enjoyed her increasing responsibility, and was saving to buy a house. There was an important presentation on Tuesday she had to help prepare for, the sort of project she enjoyed. Yet she hadn't shown up at work. Police investigations are rarely the stuff of high drama seen on TV. Often it's the small details that tell the story. For Detective Young, who'd seen at least 1,000 missing person cases in his career, all those aberrations from St. Laurent's normal routines were significant. Everyone had said the same things about Amy St. Laurent with respect to her responsibilities. She was regular. She was faithful. She was close to her family and would not behave in a manner that would alarm them. She would not neglect a helpless animal to go off and have fun. Detective Young relayed his concerns to his supervisor in the Criminal Investigation Division, Detective Sergeant Tommy Joyce, who was also at home. Joyce, like Young, felt that the sudden changes in St. Laurent's behavior were a cause for concern. Although neither of them was scheduled to work that evening, they decided to drive back into Portland to see what they could do about finding the missing woman. Sergeant Joyce called his lieutenant, Joseph Laughlin, for permission. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine, by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. My name is Randy Labar. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. Thank you for listening.